Welcome, everyone, to the first step of A Convenient Parallel Discussion, where each week we'll discuss two chapters of the book, A Convenient Parallel Dimension, How Ghostbusters Slimed Us Forever, written by James Green Jr. I'm Dan Lieberg of the Buffalo Ghostbusters. Joining me today are James, Eric Christensen from the Moogly Fan Club, and several members of the Buffalo Ghostbusters, including Brent Hollingsworth, Josh Brown, and Christopher Burns Jr. We had originally planned to be live on Facebook, where everyone could join, leave comments, ask questions, all of that. But unfortunately, due to technical difficulties, we were not able to get the live video feed to work tonight. So instead, we recorded it as a podcast format. We hope you enjoy.
Oh, and a bit of an unexpected twist. We're coming to you with just some audio for the first episode here of A Convenient Parallel Discussion. I'm Dan Lieberg of the Buffalo Ghostbusters, joined by several other members of the Buffalo Ghostbusters, Eric Christensen from the Moogly Fan Club, and our guest of honor, James Green Jr., the author of A Convenient Parallel Dimension, How Ghostbusters Slimed Us Forever. Welcome, everyone.
So hi, everyone.
Let's jump right into it. Josh, you have all the notes. Why don't you start with, why don't you start? Go ahead.
All right, James. So, really, how hard was it to find all the information that you got for the book?
It was like sort of constant, like everyday work. Some of it was not that hard to come by. Some of it was very difficult. I mean, it kind of did, you know, it was one of those things where I was like, I had something every day. I had to sit down and be like, okay, I gotta try to figure this out or source this or whatever. I guess it depends on what, I think, like, in terms of like the first chapter, like filling out a lot of the, you know, what, like the background information where like Ivan Reitman and Bill Murray and, you know, Dan Aykroyd and all them came from, it was like a kind of like, like, well, I just tried to dig up as many old newspapers and magazines and stuff as I could to, you know, kind of cross-reference all the information. It was difficult, but sometimes, quite often, actually, there would be like, oh, this happened, and then this happened, and then suddenly I was on Saturday Night Live, and it's like, well, okay, so, but what, let's try to find a little more information about, you know, but yeah, this, that, how do we get from A, B to C, you know? Let's see if we can fill that in a little bit more. And, you know, there's a lot of information that I was curious in that I ended up not being able to track down or, confirm or verify. So.
Oh, and sure. I do think that was a really interesting point in the intro, that the book is unlicensed because you didn't want to have Sony make any edits or anything. I thought that was an interesting point, that you wanted to tell the story and not have to go through their approval process.
Yeah. I mean, that's one of the big reasons I decided to write the book, was I felt like, even though there had been a lot of great official Ghostbusters books and releases and stuff, I knew just from being a fan, there was a lot of stuff that those materials were leaving out. And, I didn't even assume that they'd make that kind of offer, you know. I just, because I had contacted, Ivan Reitman and Dan Aykroyd and Paul Feig and told them about the book, and I was just expecting either to get a yes or no on interviews and something. They're like, well, what if we offer to license the book? And, they're like, you know, the caveat is that we get, like, final cut. And I was like, no, yeah. I don't think that's good. So,
yeah.
No, but I have a feeling. In our little preamble here, when we were trying to get this to work, it was, several of us brought it up that you just mentioned there are these other official sources out there and official books and stuff like that have covered stuff. But all of us already feel, you know, only two chapters in, that we're learning a whole bunch of new stuff that wasn't covered before,
which is awesome to hear, and that makes all the hard work worth it.
So I guess
funny because
what was the timeline? When did you start to like work on the book?
Well, I wanted to start. I actually wanted to do this book in 2013, like after my first book was published, and you know, that didn't really work out at the time. And then I kind of moved on to other stuff, and I guess in like January of 2019, that's when they announced they were doing Afterlife. And I kind of was having trouble selling the book that I was working on at that time. And I kind of felt like, you know, Afterlife announcement kind of energized me as a fan of Ghostbusters. And I thought, well, what if I dust off that Ghostbusters book proposal? And that's basically what I did. And I emailed the publisher and I was like, what if we, can we give this a try? Because I think that now would be a good, I think everything's kind of different now. We can give it a shot. And they're like, yeah, let's do it. So basically from then until, I want to say, I worked on it from then until March, April, May of last year. the final couple months really were a blur.
Wow. Wow. That.
So when writing this book,
it just seems like there.
What? Sorry. When writing this book, did you actually get to sit down with Dan and Ivan and do interviews?
No, I didn't. Well, as soon as I told Sony and Ghost Core I didn't want to license the book, that was like, you know, the curtain slamming down on them. But so I didn't get to talk, unfortunately. You know, but I also kind of felt like, well, they've been interviewed about this stuff so many times, and I kind of had one of the toughest things, I think, in doing what I do, you know, or at least it's one of the toughest things in like interviewing people for these things is quite often people of that stature have like, you know, they have like their like script for interviews, like stories they want to tell, and it's like it's tough to like, you know, get them to really dig. And it's like, how much time am I really going to get from Dan Aykroyd? You know, like I'm not a name writer. You know, like can I assume that like, you know, I felt like as soon as all that was off the table, I kind of felt, all right, maybe that makes it harder in some respects, but it's also like, you know, now I can find other avenues and you know, just work with what the hundreds and hundreds of interviews that they've given already, you know, to piece that together. Yeah. So
after the book came out, all the spots.
I'm sorry, Josh, what was that?
I said you just kind of like filled in all the gaps there from, or connected the dots, I should say, from interview to interview. And just soaked up all this information and put it out there for us.
Yeah, and you know, I interviewed a lot of below the line people, like, you know, the assistant directors and, you know, editors and stuff who worked on the movies. And mm-hmm. you know, it's like, you know, they had differing recollections or differing stories about, you know, what was, and then yeah, you never know how people are going to remember stuff or what they're going to remember, how, you know. It always kind of surprises me what certain, you know, you talk to some people and they'll tell you something that seems innocuous and they'll immediately be like, wait, that was off the record. And you think, like, why? Like, what could possibly be weird about, you know. But yeah, it definitely a lot of connecting the dots. And like, yeah, like I said, there were many dots that could not be. I tried my best.
Well, because even that kind of came up in, I forget which actress it was, but just in terms of memories changing and all of that, was the one actress that Harold Ramis remembered having turned down a part in Ghostbusters because of the script material or something, and she's like, that never happened.
Yeah,
like,
yeah, that was,
Anne
Carlisle from Liquid Sky, yeah.
So it's just interesting the way people tell stories over and over again, but then their memory starts to change.
Yeah.
I don't remember.
That's like, have you had anybody like, push back or anything?
No, I haven't actually. You know, I'm kind of surprised because I feel like there were a couple people. Who I interviewed where I kind of felt like they were telling me something, and they were obviously not entirely comfortable with, you know, it's kind of hard to describe, but you could tell they were like hesitant, or maybe it seemed to me like maybe this isn't their favorite thing to discuss. And I remember like telling those people like, hey, the book is out if you want to check it out. And if anyone's had any problem with it, they haven't brought it to me, you know. So
nobody at Sony either? Nobody
I haven't
fuss or anything?
No, not at all. I think they were honestly, it seems like a lot of Sony's concern in our brief discussions was that I wasn't going to be like abusing the copyright or the logos or something. They're like, where are you getting all the images from? And I'm like, well, the publisher has an account with this photo service, so we're just going to pull everything from there. That was like, you know, really helpful to know about that stuff. And I haven't heard of anything at all. Of course, this is like, you know, that maybe that'll be different when, you know, the hardcover has only come out so far. The soft cover comes out like next year, I think. You know, I don't know if that'll get more attention or if that'll. So. That was a cat, right?
So
a
cat?
Yeah, like, that's my cat.
Oh my god.
That's my cat. Yeah, that cat's name is Venkman. That cat's name is Venkman.
I was like, guys, you could just raise your hand if you want to talk. You don't have to meow.
That's the new official way how we did it. So I do
meow.
Just get little hand signs made.
I've always heard the story that Eddie Murphy was up for the role of Winston Zeddemore. And then in this, you debunked it by basically saying, no, he with Philomene by the time he got the information or even signed for Beverly Hills Cop.
Yeah. I mean, the more I looked into that, the more it just seemed like Eddie Murphy was trying not to hurt anybody's feelings. And like probably was, if you look at his career, the way his career was moving at that point, it's like he obviously wanted to do like a starring role where he wasn't part of an ensemble, you know? And I mean, Ivan Reitman had said like, you know, we just considered Eddie Murphy. We never talked to him, which may not be true. Who knows? If they did ask Eddie Murphy, obviously he was like, I don't really want to do it. But yeah, like the facts are like, you know, the Beverly Hills Cop was supposed to be Stallone up until like 2 days before filming started. And I don't know or I don't recall why Sylvester Stallone dropped out, but it was like this mad scramble. Like, this movie's going to start shooting. We need a star. So they got Eddie Murphy and they're like, we'll make it funny. We'll do a funny Beverly Hills Cop.
Well, you know, there was always talk that Winston's character had a lot more to it. And then it was just cut. Bare minimum.
Yeah, this is the first I've heard that he was like,
if Eddie Murphy had been in the movie.
I mean, obviously, I think at that time, everybody wanted Eddie Murphy to be in anything, you know, like everybody was after him. So I think that if Eddie Murphy had been hired, you know, they probably would have been a lot different, you know. But, you know, who's to say? Who's to say that? I don't know. It would have been interesting because, like, I'll just go ahead.
Oh, so I was just going
to
say, I think one pretty interesting thing about Winston's role being cut down, the aspect that he was originally supposed to bring in stuff that he thought of, I don't think that would have played as well, you know, with the Winston we know as the Everyman and all that, where it's forgivable that it's right because he's just like an innocent guy and all that. And like, but if it were the one guy who's not the scientist, it would be like, oh, why didn't you just listen to them and clear your mind? Like, I don't know. I thought that was interesting. As I read that, I was like, yeah, I don't think that would have played as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And this was the first time I ever learned that the role was. I've always heard the background of, oh, he was an Air Force officer, this, and then the original script, he was their security officer.
Yeah, I believe the novel has him as a veteran.
protecting these nerds. Just no, don't mess with them, nerds. So just let them do their thing.
I would have actually honestly liked to have Winston had the been the one who manifested Stay Puft. I could have seen that.
Could you picture Eddie Murphy's face if he had just seen Stay Puft after popping in his head?
Yeah, I can imagine Eddie Murphy's laugh watching Stay Puft.
You know, we've talked about Eddie Murphy being Winston Zeddemore, but there's a couple of different characters that were mentioned in the book that could have been played by different actors. Belushi to Venkman, Richard Pryor to Winston Zeddemore, Kelly McGillis playing Dana Barrett in Zool, and Sandra Bernhardt playing Janine's role. Like, Ghostbusters actually could have looked so different. I had no idea that Kelly McGillis was even up for the role of Dana Barrett.
Yeah, I didn't either before I started this book. I wanted to interview her, and I had a friendly back and forth with her her agent. She was like, I guess, not really interested in discussing it. They were nice.
Yeah, it really is interesting how different this whole thing could have been. I mean, you know, hearing some of the changes that were made and the positive things that were brought on by different people, like Sigourney making Dana into a musician rather than an actress. I think that plays so mm-hmm. much better. Dana being an alien, that would have been weird.
Yeah.
But, like, I liked what Harold Ramis had to say about, that once Sigourney came in, the romantic aspect wasn't a gag anymore because you don't use Sigourney Weaver that way. Like, that, I think that really played well for the movie.
Mm-hmm. Or all the actors asking, are you sure you read the script?
Going back to Winston, because I just flipped through the book real quick. Reginald Val Johnson being auditioning for Winston, and then just getting that small little walk-on part.
Yeah, that's definitely an interesting note.
I had heard an interview with Ivan that said that he texted really well, and that they wanted to give him something in the movie, so they ended up giving him the police officer. Or the corrections officer, I guess, whatever you want to call it. But I had heard that one. And now you got Carl Winslow, and you got Al Powell or whatever. And it's funny how his career has kind of been like cop, cop, cop all the way through. But yeah, I mean, the Ghostbusters could have looked so much different than what we actually got on the screen, but I'm very thankful for what we have. Here's another one: Evo Shandor as the boss of the Ghostbusters,
right? In the original, very futuristic,
interdimensional space traveling team.
That one really, really kind of like blew my mind because now I see him as the one of the major villains from, the video game and after, Afterlife coming out, he's a villain. And I'm trying to wrap my brain around him being the boss of the Ghostbusters. I just can't. I just cannot do it.
Ivan was the one that reined it in. Okay, let's make this present day. Let's mm-hmm. I'm going into business story. Let's make it this. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I thought that was funny that Reitman couldn't really get into the script, and kind of set it aside and forgot about it. That's like so interesting that, we all know the stories of Dan's first drafts being so technical or out there or whatever, but like the fact that it was something that Reitman was even just like, yeah, all right,
phasing time.
So.
But it is funny, like we were saying with, you know, checking with all the actors, like, have you read the script and everything? It is so interesting that Bill Murray was, like, you know, with his history, I think we talked about this when we were just in preview, but Bill Murray's history of, you know, being reluctant to do the sequels or, you know, being difficult to work with, he kind of has a weird reputation of that, but... the fact that he saw the first third of the original script of Ghostbusters and was so committed and so into it is just really very interesting.
Well, and that goes back to, I think I heard in an interview, I think it was Reunited Apart. It was a Reunited Apart episode where he saw the there was like a Thanksgiving dinner or something like that. And they all watched it together, and he was just like, "All right, this is the movie. This is what we're doing. I'm excited for it." And no one else remembered that. The whole cast was there. No one remembered that except for him. And I think that if it did happen, then that just goes to show how much of an impression that first little bit that he saw made on him, and he was just like so gung-ho about doing the rest of the film.
Yeah, the quote right at the end of chapter two, I knew we could be late every day for the rest of our lives, because they had this massive hit on their hands.
And they were all confident with that, buying houses, and before the movie had even come out, they were so confident this was going to be a huge hit.
How about the soundtrack stuff? That was pretty interesting. Like, you know, we got to get the Alessi brothers to dig up their original pitch if they have that. Now that we got them coming to Ghostbusters Day, let's hear their version of whatever they came up with. Right?
Yeah. When I read that, Dan, my first thought was I got to ask Dan to get them to do that for us.
I thought the story.
I don't remember who it was exactly commented, "Oh, you just wanted us to steal it? We could have done that."
Right?
Yeah, it was the Alessis that said that. Yeah. And I think that's so funny, too, because obviously everybody knows about the famous lawsuit over that and everything, and I definitely never knew sort of Reitman's involvement in that. He liked I Want a New Drug and was kind of almost even using that as an example to people, like, "Hey, this is what I like, do something like this." And
do something,
you know,
like that. Yep.
There you go. Like, I didn't know that he was involved in that way.
The Ray Parker Jr.
So this is a true story about all of this. During our Firehouse Ghostbusters Day, I got to talk with Billy and Bobby Alessi for a little bit, and I was telling them how their song gives me chills, and I was getting chills like talking to the artist about it. And James, swear to God, they told me almost verbatim what is in the book about how they said something like, "Well, we didn't know you wanted us to just steal it," or something. It's something like that. That's what the line is. They said that to me almost verbatim, and I was like, "Oh, that's cool. That's really cool." I was like, and then I told them, because I had read this book. I got this book for, I think it was either Christmas or my birthday or something like that. And I had read the first couple of chapters before, and I told them that I had read it in this book that I'm reading. And they were like, what? That's in a book? And I was like, "Oh, well, yeah, it's in a book. Like, that whole story."
That's funny, because I emailed them when the book came out, and they're like, "Awesome, we'll go get it. You know, thanks for interviewing us." And I was like, "No, thank you." So they didn't remember.
I got the most quizzical look from them. Like, what?
Well, that's another very interesting thing is about working on this book or any other book I've done is that, like, people will agree to talk. I'll write out like a long email and be like, "My name is James Green and I'm working on this book and I'd like to interview you for it. This is what the book is going to be like. This is what I envisioned. This is the other books that I've done." Then often I'll get on the phone with them and talk to them for an hour, and they'll be like, "So what is this? Was this for a magazine article?" Like, is this going to be in the newspaper?
books! So. Who reads books?
Print is dead.
Print is dead.
Very good.
Dead. Yep, print is dead.
Yeah. So, but the Alessi brothers were super nice guys when I, all through the whole time working on the book when they interviewed him. So, you know.
Yeah, we love them. They were awesome at Ghostbusters Day, and they're coming back next year. So I think they're realizing the fandom actually like really loves them. You know, so many people came up to them at Ghostbusters Day telling them that their song is actually their favorite on the soundtrack. You know, Saving the Day is their favorite song on the soundtrack. And it was kind of funny. Like, they definitely had a look on their face the first few times, like, oh, wow. And then it eventually became, wow, like, really? This many people? Like, but, I mean, I know it is for me, for sure.
I mean, you have to, I think it's, you know, they've had such a, like, you know, they did, they sang backup vocals for, like, Barbara Streisand, and they did backup on, like, that John Lennon. Mm-hmm. Milk and Honey. And then when I interviewed them, they're like, we just got back from England, like the royal family flew us out there to perform for them.
Oh my god.
So like, I think they've done a ton of like you know, I think it seems like in their it might be easy for them to forget they did Ghostbusters because they did. They've been involved in so much other crazy high profile
stuff. Yeah,
for sure.
Yeah,
you just imagine them playing Saving the
Day.
Oh yeah,
right. That's what happened. The Queen saw their performance at Ghostbusters Day and was like, "I want to fly them out and have them play them." That's totally what.
That's why they couldn't make it year two for the second year, Dan. They had to go to England.
Yeah, that's it.
That's what it was. Yep.
I actually loved. I had a big smile on my face reading about the whole marketing and. How, you know, it's very famous that the teaser poster just had the logo and all that. And it occurred to me that that was because they didn't yet have the title locked in and didn't have the rights. And it's been hailed as this, like, genius marketing strategy, and it's now, like, one of the most recognizable logos in the world. Not obviously because of the marketing strategy, but, you know, in general, that certainly plays into it in part. But, yeah, I just thought that was so interesting that it was actually because they didn't have the rights to the title yet. Yeah. And but obviously it all worked out.
Yep. You know, it's I was looking in chapter 2, you talk about Michael C. Gross and the creation of the Moogly logo. And a little background on me real quick. I'm actually a patch designer in the community. So I play with Moogly a lot. And I run the Moogly fan club, as Dan said. But I love the sentence that you mentioned that Bill Murray loved showing off the patch that he had on his arm, but he hated wearing the uniform. Then you go on to say, well, is this something actually a Ghostbuster would wear or something like that?
Yeah,
I thought it was cool.
Yeah, they were doing like a joint interview with Roger Ebert and Dan Aykroyd. Like, well, you know, if this was a real job, this is what we'd wear. And Bill Murray was like, whatever. But the patches.
Yeah.
But the patches.
So like, what studio was it only just Columbia at that point that was interested in Ghostbusters? What other studios were possibly interested in this?
Well,
I do know that there was a,
I mean, I've heard, you know, I heard something I could never verify was that, you know, I heard that Dan Aykroyd originally had an idea, like, I'll give this to John Landis and we'll do it for Paramount. And then there was apparently, like, you know, still, but he wanted Ivan Reitman involved somehow as well. And that fell apart allegedly because of the bad blood between Landis and Reitman over Animal House. And, you know, Dan Aykroyd had an office on the Universal lot, and so I imagine that Universal, you know, the stories that I found about, like, you know, about all the other studios that were buying for Ghostbusters, didn't really give concrete examples, you know. It was just like, I'm sure, you know, probably every studio at that time was like, oh, Bill Murray and Dan Aykroyd, you know, and Ivan Reitman, you know, it was probably like, yeah, mm-hmm. we'd all love to get in on that. So, yeah.
They were huge. They were huge then.
A documentary that mentioned something mm-hmm. about that, where Dan was at Universal and then got the approval there, but then it fell through. And then that guy went to Columbia and he was able to get it there, but I could be wrong.
Yeah, this is another thing where it's like, you don't, like, their memories, even though they've talked about this probably every single day of their lives, what they say doesn't really jibe with, like, you know, the contracts that I saw were already for, like, their salaries and stuff for Ghostbusters were all, like, were already being drawn up in early May of 83. And that's, like, you know, according to the stories Ivan Reitman tells, it's like, we didn't get the deal until, like, mid-May. You know, it's just, you know, there's obviously misremembering and, like, you know, so it's tough to say, you know, for sure exactly.
Which I found that really interesting too, because I don't know that I ever had heard the salaries that they had made. Like, Bill Murray made $3 million, that Sigourney Weaver actually got, you know, percentage points on the box office and everything. I didn't know that. I'm actually bringing up, I want to know what that equates to. $3 million in 1984 money. What does that adjust to?
Probably somewhere around 15 now. Maybe 20?
Okay, well, not 30 million.
And if Sigourney was getting a percentage of the box office hits, then she might have possibly gotten a lot more.
Yeah. Well, I don't want to spoil anything for you guys, but
Hollywood math.
Yeah, I mean, when you get to the chapters about Ghostbusters 2 and, you know, why Sigourney didn't get her money for a long time.
Oh, jeez.
What?
Yeah.
So, just FYI, everyone, $3 million in 1984 is worth $8.8 million today. Hmm.
That would still be quite low. Hmm.
Wow. But no, definitely lots of good stuff to come. I like the little tease of what's to come on Ghostbusters 2 information. Obviously,
yeah,
it's been great so far, so I'm sure we're all going to keep learning a lot.
I'm sure we're all just thrilled to read the 2016 chapters.
You know what? Honestly, I am. I'm curious about a lot of the stuff that I haven't heard about that yet.
Yeah. Met mm-hmm. Paul Feig a couple of times. He is a super, super nice guy.
He's fantastic.
Absolutely. He's very nice to the fans. I've talked to him once. He shared my father's GoFundMe on his own Twitter. I'm like, you didn't have to do that, man. Like,
He did the same for me, for my dad too, because Dan had tweeted out to him, and then he had retweeted it too. So he's a super nice guy. Even meeting him at FanFest, just, you know, getting his autograph, and then going in for the photo ops, just, hey, great to see you again, and just maybe you remember me, or he's just turned out the great to see you again.
No, he's super nice, and, you know, I understand fans that don't like the movie. It, you know, everybody has their own taste. It is what it is, but I'm very excited to get to that point and read about all of the production of that, and obviously all the other abandoned Ghostbusters 3 concepts.
Everything. I did like the stuff you talked about, the deleted scenes and stuff they had to abandon in Ghostbusters.
Mm-hmm. Like the bums.
Yeah.
That does make sense that they cut that, because that's a deleted scene you can watch. And when I'm watching it, I'm just like, that's clearly, you know, Dan Aykroyd and Will Murray, and that would be totally confusing.
Why are they there?
Robert Englund.
Well, I kind of thought it was a little callback to Trading Places.
Yes.
You know, Mortimer and Randolph end up on the street, and you see them in Coming to America later on. I kind of felt it had that vibe, since Trading Places actually mentioned in the book. is one of the movies going on at the time. And it's funny, all of the movies that get listed around the time, you know, that Ghostbusters was getting ready to come out, or just in the early stages, it's amazing how it was able to stand out amongst all that great stuff. You know, they wanted it out in June to, what was it, avoid the Olympics? Is that what it was?
Yes. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Because I think it was 84 was in Los Angeles that the Olympics were.
I learned that from the book. Probably wrong. I had no idea.
Yeah.
That they wanted it to come out before the Olympics.
I do like what you said.
And then the timeline.
The music video where it's just like they're looking for people around the studio. It's the cameos.
Yeah. George West, get in here!
Yeah, I mean...
And then getting an angry letter from SAG.
Yeah, like growing up and seeing the Ghostbusters music video and seeing all these celebrities who are not in Ghostbusters in it, it's sort of like, all right, sure. Danny DeVito?
Right?
But, you know...
But, yeah.
Then you get Chevy Chase.
Go ahead. Oh, I was just going to say, you get John Candy and Chevy Chase in there, who were both, you know, early considerations for the movie. And we know Chevy Chase turned it down and all the stuff that happened with John Candy and the character. And I will point out from the book I learned, I didn't know that Lewis's character was originally supposed to be some kind of like handsome womanizing guy.
Yeah, sleazy and all that.
Yeah. Prior. Yeah. Because I've always, you know, you've always heard the John Candy version where he was German and he had the two dogs and
yes,
all
that's
that.
The version but, I always heard too. And Ivan was like, no, we don't need that. We don't want dogs. We already have the dogs. It's going to confuse people.
In the novelization, I'm pretty sure it's still the womanizing Lewis Tully. Because that's one of the big changes. Hmm.
Novelization. Definitely. You know, that would explain the tracksuits he wears.
Yeah.
All the leisure suits.
nothing sexier than a nice accountant, right?
You know, as I watch this, or as I read this book, and I've watched a lot of behind the scenes documentaries and read more books, I really do think that the behind-the-scenes stuff could be a movie itself. I mean, we're talking a timeline of just about 10 months, creating special effects and writing and shooting this film. And I really do think that it could be a movie itself, and the movie could be called A Convenient Parallel Dimension.
So when can we see a movie deal for this come out?
There you go.
What's the line from Ghostbusters 2? You know, paperback's not out for another year. TV movie of the week.
I'm glad you made the joke first.
But seriously, I mean, it could be a movie. Like, and this, when I read books, it's I can almost like see them as a movie. So this reading this book, it's kind of like reinforced that whole thing. I would totally watch a movie of how Ghostbusters was made.
Like a true behind the scenes movie would be great. And this is like reading what, like you said, Josh, would be a movie.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. You kind of think about The Offer, the Godfather series that was out?
Yeah, yeah. Kind of like The Offer. I know there's a couple of movies about movies out there made.
Oh, like they made one on The Room a few years ago.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, The Disaster Artist or whatever it's called. But
wow. Mm-hmm. I'm glad that you guys... feel that my writing is that strong because one of the reviews that really sticks with me is this guy writes like a first grader.
Wow!
Did you respond to the review? You write reviews like a first grader.
No. I mean, I can't be. I mean, if that's what they believe, then that's fine. I've had plenty of people tell me the book is good or great. So if some people don't like it, that's fine.
Now, who is the book in your eyes? Who is the book for? Is it for just the casual movie fan, or is it for the hardcore Ghostbusters fan?
Well, I think it's for everybody. I think it's for anybody who, like, I tried to write it so if you know a lot about Ghostbusters already, maybe there's some stuff in there that would surprise you. And if you don't know anything about it, maybe you learn, you know, the whole story. Or if you're just a fan of, like, you know, behind the scenes Hollywood stuff, you know, my idea really was like, I don't remember if I said this when we were recording, but like, it was what the book that I would want to read about Ghostbusters, like with all of the information that, you know, is left out of the official accounts and like really what tells you like where, you know, where these people came from and what tries to explain their motivations.
Absolutely.
I've had it for a long time, and I just have not gotten off my ass to actually read it. I don't read much at all, but so I'm glad we put this together, because now this is, I have deadlines. I'm like, okay, I have to read chapters 1 and 2 by Sunday. That I'm finishing it at noon on Sunday.
Some of us may have just read chapters 1 and 2 today.
We got busy schedules.
I have been reading this book at work, and my job is I can just supervise people, but like I have been reading this book at work, and I've been done with it, the introduction, chapter 1, chapter 2, for what, guys, like about a week and a half.
Yeah,
you've been,
and I've been dying.
Well, right. Especially because originally we were going to do the first one last week.
Last week, yeah. And I've been dying to talk with people about this book for a while. I remember when I first got it and I read the first 2 chapters before, and I was texting Dan, dude, Slimer was like a cocaine fever dream. Can you believe this? Yeah, and he was like,
he just like, oh, I just put some lines of coke off of a picture of John
Belushi.
I don't know if I believe that story.
Yeah.
It is the 80s, though.
Yeah, it's very believable. It was the 80s.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't think I put any. I interviewed that Steve Johnson who tells that story. I don't think I used anything from our interview in the book, but it's like, after talking to him, I was like, okay, maybe this actually happened. But it's also sort of like, well, you know, I don't know.
I don't know. It seemed kind of out of place because, you know, you go on to mention how after John passed away that Dan, you know, almost threw in the towel for acting altogether. You know, he took it that hard, you know, the alcoholism and all that. So the story that, you know, he'd be doing cocaine off of his photo or something almost just seems backwards.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, I don't know.
Well, but that was Steve Johnson, the designer, not Dan doing the cocaine.
Yeah. And it's very devastating for, you know,
oh, that's what I meant.
Hearing that story with Dan where he's like, calls him on the phone, hey, you know, I'm going to come out there, you know, just hang on. And then basically the next day he passed away from an overdose, and that's going to be devastating because.
Yeah. Yeah, it seems like it was really tough. You know, everybody wanted him to, you know, turn it around. And it seemed like he had a lot of, not just Ghostbusters, he had a lot of cool opportunities of like on the table, you know. But, couldn't get it together.
Yeah. That's, I mean, the comparison's been made a million times, but it seems like it's just so apt that it's just like Chris Farley.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and ironically, also connected to Ghostbusters because he was, you know, maybe going to be in the Ghostbusters 3 at one point. And, you know, same thing.
Was that more fan casting or was that just like the 90s rumors with that?
I guess you got to read the book, Brent.
Well, I'll be a nice guy. I'll be a nice guy and say that he was definitely like gonna. Before he died, he was definitely gonna be in whatever they were working on. Like,
I remember Chris Farley, Will Smith. And that was just from like the '90s.
Yeah.
Stuff, so. Yeah.
No, I guess yeah, Dan Aykroyd.
Don't forget Ben Stiller.
Oh yeah, Ben Stiller. Yeah.
Yeah, he was.
I still think they should have them all in Firehouse, just as cadets, like, or people waiting in line to interview for the new position. You know, Ghostbusters is open again. And Eddie Murphy.
Oh, God.
Anybody who was considered for an old role, just sitting there with resumes, like, okay, let's go, let's go, let's go.
I want to see old Chevy Chase come in, and then just turn him down.
Mm-hmm. I was just about to say Chevy Chase.
Yep.
Come in and just be like, nope, we're good.
Chevy Chase could walk in and then Will Smith could punch him.
Yep. Eddie Murphy could come in and go, you know, I thought about interviewing to you guys, you know, 40 years ago, but I decided to be a cop instead. Now I'm, you know, kind of change career or something like that.
Just retired from the force in Beverly Hills. I was wondering if I could interview with you guys.
I could see like Will Smith just showing up in like a black suit, like, I've dressed all well for this interview too.
Dan, well, you're writing this all down so you can email it to Eric for, you know, when they get
Yeah. Well, I got through all my notes that I took on the first two chapters.
Yeah, I got through the majority of mine. So I think we're good on that one.
Yeah, so, all right, so that's chapters 1 and 2. That's the first episode with more than a couple speed bumps, so hopefully we'll get those figured out this week, and we'll be ready to go next week so that some fans can join us and possibly, you know, comment or whatever, and or ask questions if anybody has questions for you, James. I don't think they'll have questions for us. But, yeah, other than that, I'm all set,
we're
guys.
Interesting.
Everybody, thanks for, and James, certainly, thanks for putting up with all the little hiccups on this one.
Thank you for joining us.
No, my pleasure. Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you so much, James.
Thank you.
Thank you, everyone, for listening. We hope to have the technical difficulties solved by next week so that we can get back to our original planned format where we'll be live on Facebook and you can all join us to chat, leave comments, or ask questions for James. Thank you all for joining A Convenient Parallel Discussion. Enjoy your week.